Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Today, SDPB brings you Governor Dennis Dugard's State of the State Address. That is live a little bit after 1 p.m. Central, noon Mountain. But first, on In the Moment, we talk with members of the incoming class of freshman lawmakers. Now, not all new members of the legislature so designated are actually new to the process. Today, we hear from veteran Democrat Susan Wismer.
I was first elected in 2008. I served in the House for 6 years. And then, as I told my tax office clients who would come in and say, oh, aren't you in the legislature? And I'd say, no. Don't you remember? I couldn't run for two offices at the same time. So I earned myself a two-year hiatus in 14, and I enjoyed it immensely. But I'm looking forward to getting back to peer.
What makes you want to come back after you've had a little taste of the freedom of January?
Well, I could say all those silly bills that they talk about really continuing in that same vein. When you're sitting on the House floor listening to the discussions of some bills that I think are just a waste of time, I have to be careful that I don't roll my eyes too much because the cameras might catch it. But when I was sitting here in my office listening, I could do that all I wanted. Nobody could see me. So, yeah, yes, it's very frustrating, but it's worthwhile, important work, and there's a limited population of people who are able to spend that large a chunk of their year in the legislature, and I think it's very important that we have people in Pierre who aren't single issue, aren't motivated just by a single issue, and that are willing to listen to both sides, and I feel like I am. Mm.
Do you take
one of those people?
How do you prepare for a session then? How do you gear up and get yourself ready for the issues that are coming at you in 2017?
Well, part of it is just the being generally aware of all sorts of things that if your ears aren't tuned to county and state and school government issues, you might miss. It's the get-togethers that are going on now in spite of IM-22 visits with school superintendents and law enforcement and nursing home administrators to try to catch up on how things have changed. But really, my first 6 years in the legislature were all an appropriations committee, and so I just kept my focus there in those 6 years. I am going to move away from appropriations. That committee can be, well, it can be frustrating for anyone, but it's particularly frustrating for Democrats that know that the budget has been set by the governor. All the little loose ends will be tied up in a closed meeting between the governor's people and the majority legislators, and the rest of it's pretty much just a show. So I decided to try to move out to some other subject areas. I'll be on tax and judiciary, and then the Government Operations and Audit Committee this time around.
Any priorities going in on those committees, topics that you're particularly keen to dig into?
Well, yeah, probably the juvenile justice reform is uppermost in our minds in this part of the state. The changes that were made by Senate Bill 73 2 years ago and that went into effect about a year ago now are really having some terribly adverse effects on the atmosphere in our schools. And so far, it just appears to me that the administration is chalking up a lot of the difficulties to communication issues. There are a lot of parties involved, corrections, UJS, the schools, law enforcement, state's attorneys, and they do all, and it's all a different way of doing things. But whatever the issue is, we need to keep working on it. And I think it may very well require some legislative fixes, because schools just feel like they have, that we've taken away all of the tools in their toolbox that help them address issues like school truancy, for one. And there are all sorts of things there that need to be addressed.
So give me an idea of some of those adverse effects you're seeing. Then if tools have been taken out of the toolbox, what are the consequences of that?
Well, that's just it. There aren't any consequences, it seems like. There was a meeting in October in Milbank of just everyone from the community. All of the affected parties were there. Again, the schools, law enforcement, state's attorney, UJS, and then there were some representatives there from peer. But I really felt like the representatives from peer were not hearing what the local community was saying. There was a counselor from Sisseton, for the Sisseton School District, who said, you know, I used to have a couple of pages of kids on probation, and if they were on probation, they were answerable to me and or their probation officer for certain things, and we had a way to probation was a way to try to motivate them to come to school or discouraging them from petty crimes. And now truancy in particular, it just seems like the process is breaking down between the school to the sheriff to the state's attorney. Some of those parties believe that they don't have that there are no repercussions if they report a student for truancy to the sheriff. The sheriff, after filling out the paperwork a few times, taking it to the state's attorney, learning that really there was no consequence to that student, or perhaps there was a $100 fine, which they say is just nothing these days, is not enough to discourage the student from continuing the negative pattern of behavior. And so we've, as a result, truancies are going unaddressed, and schools, and also if they feel like they have a student in danger, in a dangerous family situation, maybe they haven't, gone to the extreme that gets them a more serious citation or definitely puts them in on the path to a juvenile correction facility. But because those stopping points aren't there along the way, they really fear that it, in the long run, we'll end up with many more kids in the correction system because we're not stopping them.
Can Senate Bill 73 be fixed, do you think?
Oh, yeah. It has to be. The situation in the schools now just cannot be allowed to stand. It has to be.
You went, I'm sure you attended the budget address, Governor Dugard's budget address, your experience on appropriations.
I listened to it, yeah. I didn't make the trip, but I listened.
Any initial impressions about the year ahead from that address?
As a recovering appropriator, yeah, I paid pretty close attention to that. You know, I missed the 2 years where the governor made efforts to and partially addressed two of the most critical issues that South Dakota has. In 15, he did, after the reelection, he did support finally highway tax increases, gas tax increases, and vehicle registration fee increases. And then last year he did address education, albeit really it It needed to be about twice as much as what we finally they finally accomplished. Well, this year should have been Medicaid's year. There was summer study on Medicaid methodologies and on nursing home beds in the state. They have worked very hard. Several parties have worked diligently to try to come to an agreement to expand Medicaid that would have addressed several of the terrible medical situations on our reservations, and none of that has happened. Now with the change in primarily the ag economy, you know, we've got sales tax receipts that are coming in a little lower than projected, and so it's going to be really tough to do anything for Medicaid, mm-hmm. even though there are just some extremely dangerous and harmful situations going on, not only in our nursing homes. There was a nursing home in my legislative district way up in the corner, a little town called Rossholt, who closed their nursing home just a few weeks ago. And then I've been keeping my eye on situations in Redfield and Yankton at the human services agencies there, both of which have been severely impacted by labor shortages mm-hmm. caused because we're not paying our people enough, but also because of an administrative problems, whether it's not being able to get an administrator at the Yankton facility because our pay scale is not in the necessary range, or just because of the poor working conditions. I think there are definitely some administration issues that have complicated and exacerbated the situations mm-hmm. at both Redfield and Yankton.
Do you think in Yankton that situation made a turn at all in 2016 with the new administrator?
Well, it's kind of hard
raises?
For me to tell from way up here. I have listened to the interviews that the interim committees have had. I believe that new administrator has appeared at least once in front of government operations and audit. Mm. And it sounds good, but it's really hard to tell from that sort of interview.
Sure. Initiated Measure 22, you brought it up. Has that changed? Or what impacts have you seen from IM 22 this year that are different from your experience before?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, number one, it's just a distraction from the really important budget issues. It's, you can put the bathroom bill and all the hoop-de-doo about IM-22 in the same basket as far as being distractions from the important issues that we really ought to be dealing with.
How come? How so? Because everybody seems to be talking about it, and you might...
Well, it's because it's something South Dakota's never had to deal with before. Hmm. And yes, of the many, many, many things to be disappointed about in the November election, really the one that I've got to say that most impacted South Dakota that I was most disappointed about was the failure of the redistricting measure, followed closely by the failure of the open primary measure. Either one of those two would have gone so far to correct the imbalance of representation in our legislature and peer. Initiated Measure 22, of course, dealt with some hot-button issues. Yes, we had EB-5 and Yopolan and the terrible disaster down in Platte. Doesn't it seem incongruous that the disaster that Platte was, and yet here and IM-22 being one of the logical consequences, and just think how much more upset many members of the legislature are about IM-22 and how that's been expressed.
Can you articulate for me how IM-22 would have prevented a situation like what happened in Platte?
Actually, I really, yeah, okay, I'll try. It has to do with attitudes towards federal money. Mm. Our state survives. Our state is only able to provide the minimal level of public services that we do provide because of all of the federal money that we get in whatever branch of government you want to talk about. With one hand, we take and we take and we take from the feds. And on the other hand, particularly in Peer, there's just this negative, sarcastic, good enough for government work. The feds don't know what they're doing. They're fools, but we'll take their money. Hmm. In fact, we'll take as much money from them as we can figure out how to get. And what the heck? If some of us benefit a little bit on the side from it, it's just federal money. That type of attitude, that's the only way I can articulate how IM-22 could help have stopped something like Platt happening. Mm.
Do you think?
And then also just when I started in the legislature, the Department of Legislative Audit was asking for more personnel. They were not able to do their job the way they knew they ought to be doing it. Mm-hmm. They were not getting audits done and not getting them done to the depth that they needed to be done in order to uncover problems like there were for a long time down there. Hmm. And so that's how IM-22 some version of it have stopped.
Obviously, the majority of lawmakers are going to want to adjust that. Do you think that is you stand by that word distraction? Should it be moved past quickly to get to more pertinent business, or is it really important to sort of figure out what the voters' intent was and how it rolls out?
Oh, it's definitely very important to fix it and to not use all this hype as an excuse to just wipe it off the books completely, mm-hmm. or to replace it with something that sounds impressive but really has no teeth in it.
Sure.
Minnesota legislators have been living with this type of prohibition against any sort of gift or meal for a long time. Hmm. And it doesn't happen in St. Paul the same way it does in Peer. But it's not just, you know, the gift limits. It's the that's what just makes me, I want to go back and talk about redistricting and open primaries, because I think that would have such a bigger effect on the functionality of South Dakota's legislature.
What are you looking forward to most this session?
Looking forward to?
What are you looking forward to? What's going to get you in the car that day and say, "This is why I'm headed. This is why I'm going"? What are you looking forward to?
Because I know that most of the people out there are out there because they love, you know, they picked South Dakota for a reason, or they stayed for a reason, and we all love South Dakota, and we all want to keep it. Make it the best that it can be, and that's what keeps me going.
Mm. Let's leave it there. Susan Wismer, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. We look forward to hearing from you throughout the session.
Yeah, thanks.
That's Susan Wismer from District 1. We talked with her as part of our series of conversations with freshman lawmakers. We have two more of those coming up in an hour or two of In the Moment. After the break, Steve Zwemke talks with country music star Aaron Watson. Stay in the moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Aaron Watson coming up next, conversation with Steve Zwemke here. Watson's current tour stops at the District in Sioux Falls this Thursday night. Watson is Texas through and through. He has been an independent artist for his entire career, which spans 17 years and more than a dozen records. In the Moment, producer Steve Zwemke visited with Watson on Friday as he was preparing for a concert in Wichita, Kansas. Steve, why has Aaron Watson remained an independent artist for an entire career?
Well, quite simply, it's being able to control your own destiny and being able to have total ownership of your work and product. Aaron Watson kind of reminds me of Chris Ledoux during the early part of his career. He was a guy that was steadfast in being an independent artist. He was kind of a rebel, but then he actually signed with Capitol Records. So, during his early days, Aaron Watson definitely reminds me of Chris Ledoux. Watson is in a really good place right now, too. His album, The Underdog, was a big success. That was his latest album. Of course, he has the new CD coming out soon, and he just added several dates to his tour coming up this spring.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we feel so blessed. I mean, it's always exciting. You know, the weeks leading up to a new CD release, I mean, it's kind of like you're getting ready for the big game. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fans are chomping at the bit, and you know, this is kind of a place in time that I always enjoy. You know, I've been working on the Vaquero record for nearly 2 years now, so for me, you know, it's fun that we're almost, you know, I say we're almost to the finish line, but really the finish line just starts a whole new race. And so it's exciting. It's exciting. You know, the couple of months leading up to an album release, that's really where that's really where the work really begins. I mean, a lot of people make great records that nobody hears. So this is the part, this is where I transition from an artist to a businessman. And so I enjoy wearing both those hats.
I can't wait to talk more about the new album, but first of all, when did you pick up your first instrument?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I mean, I guess my first instrument would be my voice, and mm-hmm. I grew up singing at church, and, you know, since I could, right before I could walk, and, you know, then at home, Dad was always playing, you know, Willie Waylon and Merle Haggard and Beatles and Rolling Stones. So music's just always kind of been around me, and somewhere along the way I picked up a guitar and started writing songs, and you know, here I am now fixing to put out my 13th album. 17 years, 13 albums, probably 2,500 shows, and I'm an overnight success. Here we go.
And still loving it.
I love it. I love it.
Now, when you first started to play guitar, was it frustrating when you started, or were you able to stick with it right away and just continue on to where you are now?
I think maybe I kind of doggy paddled for a while before I really started swimming. But once I got going, you know, it's something that I think came fairly natural to me, but it still took a lot of hard work. You know, I'm definitely, I don't think I was gifted like some people are gifted. I mean, my oldest son, Jake, is 10 years old, and, you know, that kid, he plays Day Tripper as good as George Harrison. So, I mean, it's so easy for him. But definitely the fact that I just enjoy it, it makes it not work.
Yeah. You touched on some of your influences already, George Jones, Merle Haggard, and Willie Nelson. A lot of artists, even outside the world of country music, will know those very same people. What sets you apart from other artists who have also come up from that same musical upbringing, so to speak?
I don't know. You know, you hear a lot of mainstream guys talk about how they were influenced by those guys, but you don't hear that influence in their music. You know, I think it's always cool for somebody to say, well, I was raised on Willie and Waylon and Johnny Cash and Merle Haggard. You know, I think those guys are such icons that I think their music is bigger than any genre. So to say you love Willie doesn't mean that you're a fan of country music. You're just a fan of Willie. And I don't know what separates me. I mean, I think for me, I've stayed true to my brand of music, regardless of the changing trends. You know, you can go back and look at pictures of me in 1998, and I've got my boots, my buckle, and my cowboy hat on, and we're singing country songs. I mean, it's just, I've always loved country music. I've always loved the songwriting. And, you know, I think the thing that made guys like Willie and Waylon and Merle and George Jones, the thing that makes those guys such icons is they knew who they were, and they stayed true to their brand of music. And those, you know, we're doing our best to follow in those footsteps. You know, it's just, you know, those are great guys to look up to. I mean, Willie Nelson, even if he was a nobody, I promise you he'd be at some little bar outside of Austin probably, you know, playing for tips, because music is who Willie Nelson is.
It sounds like your family roots play a big role in that too, just like many of the others, you know, singing in church and keeping true to family and kind of keeping true to your roots. That sounds very important.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, I write my music. I write the lyrics and mm-hmm. the melody, and I sing about things that I'm passionate about. In a way, you know, I'm not just a songwriter, but I sell songs. I'm selling songs to my fans, and I believe that fans, they know when things are authentic and they know when things are artificial, and I just try my best to just write from the heart. And you know, we've always tried our very best to stay true to our faith, our family, and our fans. And you know, God's blessed us in so many ways.
If you're just joining us, we're visiting with Aaron Watson on In the Moment. In the Moment, he plays Thursday night at the District in Sioux Falls. Doors are at 7 p.m., and Zane William opens. Aaron, this isn't really a question, but I'm impressed that your new album, Vaquero, has 16 new songs.
Yeah. I mean, I love albums that have lots of music. I am not a fan of the EP. Like, I can't stand EPs. I mean, I'm a fan of music. So when one of my favorite artists says they're coming out with a new album and I get excited and then they put out a 5-song EP, I'm kind of like, you haven't put out a new album for 3 years and you could only record 5 songs? You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's just like, give me some substance. Give me a product that's good. You know, music is a business. I mean, and that's why when we're creating an album, I wanted to give the fans something they could really enjoy. And man, I wrote probably over 80 songs for the new album. And, you know, I picked the songs that had that common denominator, that common theme, songs that played into the concept of Vaquero. And which Vaquero obviously means cowboy. Mm-hmm. And there's a common theme throughout the whole record, and it is faith, family based. And it's about staying true to who you are in a day and age where everybody's talking about change. You know, is it really so bad to still stick to your roots? I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's kind of like you should be proud of your heritage. You should be proud of your family and where you come from. We try to just focus on good, wholesome things throughout Vaquero. And I wanted to make one of those records that when you're fixing to take a road trip, you put in that Vaquero album, you can listen to it 3 times over.
Well, you've kicked it off by releasing the single Out of Style, and it's catchy, it's well-written, it's relatable. Are you already playing this in your live shows?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, Out of Style is a fun song. It's definitely the worm on the hook. You know, it's catchy, fun, sounds good on the radio, sounds good live. And, you know, it's a song I wrote for my wife. You know, it's a love song. It's an upbeat love song. And it's one of those things that I wrote it. I wanted to inspire young couples, and I wanted couples who have been together for a long time, I wanted them to relate to the song.
Yeah.
That, you know, and it's a lot of fun for me. Most songs take me a long time to write. I think I wrote that in an evening like that. I wrote it all in like a night. It was crazy. The song just wrote itself.
We're never going out of style. I was thinking. Low, we could go all night. Never going out of style. Am
the new songs I've had a chance to hear tell great stories, too, and Out of Style certainly does. Also, Texas Lullaby. Now, is that a personal story? Is it about somebody you know by chance?
My dad's a disabled veteran. He's 100% disabled from serving our country during the Vietnam War. And so growing up as a little boy, I spent a lot of time going to the VA hospital with my dad. And, you know, a lot of times we were going up there to do volunteer work, you know, and I don't know that I did much except for just go around with dad and visit with old veterans. And, you know, at the time when I was going up there, they were all World War II veterans mostly. So, you know, I just, at an early age, I just developed so much love and appreciation for our veterans. And I heard an interview a while back about a soldier who survived Normandy. And I think he was 17 years old. And he said something that really impacted me, that he wasn't afraid to die. He just didn't want to die there. He wanted to die at home, surrounded by family. And I thought, man, you know, that's, it just, something about that just, it just got me, you know, it just really hit home. And so Texas Lullaby, you know, is a song from my heart, but it's also a song that just pays tribute to our veterans and our soldiers and just all that they sacrifice for us. I mean, it's called Texas Lullaby, but it's a song that, regardless of where you're from, I think you can relate to it. And that is how I want, that's how we start off the record.
He was just 18, full of fire and gasoline. He was lean and mean, and they called him Texas. He went off to war, to a far and distant shore. He'd never left his home before. He was from Texas. As they stormed that beach one foggy summer day, he said, if I don't make it back, promise me one thing. Take me home if I die. When I'm gone, don't you cry. Find some shade right beside a live oak tree. Sing those old songs of faith. So found peace, and you can bury me beneath the deep blue skies of Texas.
I think it's going to impact a lot of fans. I think they're going to love the song, and I certainly hear that as being another song that we'll hear on radio at some time.
Well, thank you. Thank you, sir.
It's been almost 2 years now since you released The Underdog, a self-released, self-promoted album, which made you the first independent male artist to debut at number one on the Billboard Country album chart. Do you stop to reflect on things like that?
Oh, yeah. Golly. I mean, I still can't believe it. It still makes me smile. You know, I mean, it's such an honor. You know, I think if I was 22 years old, I wouldn't be able to comprehend that. But, you know, when you've been doing this for as long as I have, you know, we're fixing to put out our 13th album. I mean, I'm 17 years into this, 18 years into this. You know, I don't know how many shows I've played. We're probably up, you know, 2,500 shows. So I just really had a good appreciation for how much of a blessing that was for me and my, and most importantly, my family. I mean, music, I always say music isn't an industry. It's a family business. I've always stayed independent because it's always scared me to really give some major label complete control of my career.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have so many friends on major labels that they finished a record 2 years ago and the label won't put it out. They're just sitting on it. And I'm just like, that's ridiculous. So, you know, we do what we do and we focus on staying true to our faith, our family, our fans. You know, I always tell people, we're going to keep riding a horse called hustle. Riding a horse called hard work. That's the secret. It's hard work. Get out there and work hard.
You have it figured out, and you have a good message. Are you ready for the deep freeze of South Dakota?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Aaron Watson performs Thursday night at the District in Sioux Falls. And again, his new album, Vaquero, is released on February 24th. And Lori, when he says he's able to manage our bitter cold conditions here in South Dakota this week, I believe him.
I believe him as well. He seems like he's telling the truth there. Yep. And coming up after the break, we're going to go from music to books and talk with J. Ryan Straddle. He's the South Dakota One Book author for 2017. You're in the moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. J. Ryan Straddle is the author of the book Kitchens of the Great Midwest. His book was selected as the 2017 South Dakota One Book by the South Dakota Humanities Council. I met J. Ryan Straddle at the Festival of Books in Brookings last September. That was before his book was chosen as the book the entire state is encouraged to read together this year. As you prepare your reading list for the new year, meet our newest One Book author, J. Ryan Straddle. Growing up in the Midwest matters.
Yes.
Tell me why.
We're not like anywhere else.
Yeah.
And we're not going to tell people about it. I think people have to discover us. I don't think we're inherently show people.
Right.
Yeah.
So how has going, we ask everybody this, who's grown up here and then left us behind and then comes back to visit. So what did you bring? I can never get tired of this question, but tell me what you learned kind of growing up in Minnesota that you took with you to Los Angeles and everywhere else that you've been that you really couldn't have gotten anywhere else.
Irony is overrated. Yeah. Enthusiasm and sincerity count for a lot.
That's right. Amen. Such a cheesy question, but I love asking it because that's where I'm from too. So your writing is unexpected on a micro level. Word choice really matters. Word choice is often unexpected. Structure is unexpected. Chapter titles in this book are unexpected. Is that intentional? Are you always, do you have to go through like three unexpected things till you get to the next thing, to the next word? How do you accomplish that?
Wow, that's such an interesting question. I feel like I want to describe a world that's familiar, but in a way that I haven't seen described yet. Hmm. I'm constantly looking for a novel way of interpreting mundane events. Hmm. Frankly, I'm consistently inspired by things that people would normally find mundane. And growing up in a small town in Minnesota where I had to make my own fun for most of my first 18 years, there's an awful lot of fun to be had and insight to be gleaned from the everyday if you look for it.
Lots of outdoor fun for you, right?
Oh, certainly. Yeah.
You're an outdoor kid or an indoor kid? I know the answer to this.
I read
your work, but tell us what an outdoorsman you were as a child.
A very reluctant one. Yeah. I really enjoyed the opening weekend of deer season in Minnesota because it was the time when the rest of my family would leave the house and I was finally left alone to just read books all weekend. And they wouldn't hassle me to do something I didn't want to do. I could hole up and read when everyone else is out shooting things.
Right. So yeah. when you're writing this book and there's food in it, of course, the chapter titles.
Just a bit. Yeah.
Just a bit of food. why? It's fiction. It's a literary fiction book.
The recipes are real, though.
The recipes are real. Can I go home and try them?
Yes, absolutely. I encourage it.
Get some good bars out of it. But the titles are Lutefisk bars. Now I've forgotten the rest. Give me some other titles of
Sweet pepper jelly, golden bantam, as in the sweet corn variety. Right. Walleye.
Walleye, of course. There would have to be walleye.
Yeah.
No venison.
And we're in South Dakota.
Is there
too.
Venison?
Oh yes, venison, yeah. Absolutely.
So. These are the ties that bind growing up. This is what the hot dish is what brings everyone together.
Certainly, yeah. It still does. The ingredients are a little different sometimes now.
You structured this book in sort of a risky way. Each chapter is a different. Well, tell us a little bit about the structure and how it's put together.
Right. The book is structured as a recipe for a human. Each ingredient is served in a meal that's served at the end. Or each ingredient comprises part of a dish that is part of a supper served in the final chapter. And each ingredient is introduced to the main character by a different person So these people in this food come together to approximate the life of a person, the life of my main character, Eva.
You wrote this where? Where were you at?
I was in a tiny studio apartment in Hollywood. I was as far from the Midwest in a lot of ways as you can get.
Yeah. What was that process like then? Did you feel homesick during it?
Oh, sometimes, yeah. I woke up every morning thinking about the Midwest and unlocking some of the puzzles that my upbringing created for me. I've often felt as long as people continue to confuse me, I'll have something to write about. And I felt like I had a lot of things in regards to my upbringing in the Midwest that I hadn't addressed or hadn't thought of, hadn't unpacked. Yeah. And also I felt a real need for a book set among working class Midwesterners. I hadn't seen many of them, and I certainly hadn't seen many set within the realm of their cuisine.
Mm-hmm. Will you tell me about your mother?
Oh, absolutely.
Can we go there?
Certainly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say my mom is the reason I was a writer. She went back to college when I was a kid. She was in her 30s. She had dropped out in the late 60s and returned to get her English degree when I was still in grade school. So she would read her homework assignments to me as a bedtime story. And her enthusiasm for reading and writing really struck a chord with me. And I thought the coolest thing I could do in life would be to be a writer. I came to that conclusion from observing my mom and her own enthusiasm for her writing assignments and her reading assignments.
Did she know that?
I think so, yeah.
Did she know you as a writer?
Well, she knew me as a writer from a young age when I wrote my first book. And I did that by taking my favorite book at the time, which was Richard Scarry's Cars and Trucks and Things That Go, and writing in crayon on the inside cover, written by Ryan Straddle. Sometimes you identify with something so completely, you feel like you could have done it. And perhaps that's how I felt. In any case, my mom disabused me of the notion that this is how books are written. No, you must come up with the words yourself. And after sitting on that thought for a while, I came to the conclusion that, oh, yeah, I could do that. Yeah. I'll just come up with my own words. Just that easy or difficult, as the case may be. So I've been writing ever since. My own words.
Did she give you encouragement then?
Oh, feedback? Quite a bit. Yeah, yeah, quite a bit. And there wasn't, you know, I came from an outdoorsy family of blue-collar people, and there wasn't any sort of precedent for someone attempting to make a living in a creative art. So her enthusiasm for my writing counted for quite a lot my entire life.
Did she read a lot to you as well, other than her own work?
Oh, sure. Yeah, certainly other children's books. And then later on, when I became old enough to, you know, read adult literature, we would read the same book and discuss it when I was still in school.
Will you read something from this book?
Absolutely.
You might want to set it up a little bit. And it's just another example of this wonderful, unexpected writer that I'm talking about, if you haven't read any of this yet. So we're gonna describe a woman.
All right.
In this little excerpt. So tell us who we're describing, and this is their first meeting.
We're describing Eva's mom, Cynthia. And this is the moment when her dad, Lars Torvald, who's a chef at a fictional Lake Minnetonka bistro, meets the woman that would be the father of his daughter. Amid the circumstance of a long-suffering sports team's success, the strange joy of it all spread through the restaurant. It was during these happy weeks when Cynthia Hargreaves, the smartest waitress on staff, she gave the best wine-pairing advice of any of the servers. Well, she seemed to take an interest in Lars. By this time, Lars was 28, growing a pale, hairy inner tube around his waist, and already going bald. Even though Cynthia had an overbite in the shakes, she was 6 feet tall and beautiful, and not like a statue or a perfume advertisement, but in a realistic way, like how a truck or a pizza is beautiful in the moment you want it most. This, to Lars, made her feel approachable.
This is my fist-pumping moment where I just say, oh, like a when you want it the most. I just love that. Yeah. This sort of screams book club to me. Uh-huh. It also screams independent bookseller to me. This is the kind of book that's just going to be passed out by hand by all those independent booksellers. They've been kind to you, haven't they?
Oh, extremely.
Tell me a little bit about your sort of connection to independent booksellers and small bookstores across the Midwest.
Wow, I'm so grateful for it. I went to a bookstore in Wadena, Minnesota, called An Open Book. It's a town of about 4,000 people in northern Minnesota. And 60 people came. So that's about 2% of the population. It's really, really incredible. I mean, the Vikings weren't playing that Sunday, so they might have had something to do with it. But, but I felt like I also wanted to make the effort to go to these bookstores on my own dime. And, you know, I came from a small town in Minnesota. It was very unusual for an author to come through. And I remembered it when they didn't. So I wanted to be that author that would make the effort to go to small towns in the Midwest and talk to the people who take the time out of their lives to read my book. Because frankly, it's a really amazing thing to have readers. There's so many other things you could be doing with your life. You know, you've got family, you've got work, you've got sports, you've got TV shows that you might like. You know, you're reading a book. It takes a while to engage with it. It's a choice. And I really wanted to honor the people who made that choice.
Yeah. You also help young people learn how to write. Is that correct?
Yeah. I've been doing it for 11 years.
Tell me a little bit about your work there and some of those fundamentals that kids really have a hard time overcoming to become writers.
Right. Well, some of my favorite assignments as a grade school kid were the ones that were somewhat open-ended in how they unlocked creative possibilities. One of my favorite assignments I like to give grade school students, especially third through fifth graders, are a Create Your Own Country workshop, where they draw the map, write the laws, design the flag, and interpret those parameters however they wish. And I really like to see the narratives that evolve out of that, because often they do. Often this isn't just a list of facts, but there's a story in here. And I'll sometimes see kids, you know, siblings, friends at the same table develop countries that have relationships with each other. You know? And, yeah, like Catland versus Chocolate World. You know, there's a Cold War between them, you know. Yeah. And it's
and
also.
And they make up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And they make. Sometimes they don't, right?
Yeah. We just need to pause and let that sink in for everybody. They make the worlds and the worlds will have relationships. That's
yes,
kind of, that's
yes.
a big, we're, you know, that's big. That's big stuff.
Absolutely.
Right there.
Yeah.
That's author J. Ryan Straddle when he joined us on stage in front of a live audience at the South Dakota Festival of Books in Brookings. His book is called Kitchens of the Great Midwest, and it's the 2017 South Dakota One Book Selection. Coming up in our second hour, as South Dakota's 2017 legislative session officially begins today with the governor's State of the State Address, SDPB's Keely Boltina joins us with a preview from Peer. Also in the second hour, we continue to meet incoming lawmakers. We've got Lion Hunter, Tim Goodwin, and rancher Steve Livermont. Plus, Hugh Weber is back with more from the Potluck Society. I'm Lori Walsh. Stay with us in the moment.